that is getting into funding agricultural things a little bit, but has traditionally funded other things. But we also operate a historic horticultural site, including both commercial and community-based agriculture. but I was formerly the director of the United States Botanic Garden, and I have some other affiliations, and so I've been very engaged in presenting agriculture in an urban context. And I want to talk about that for a second because I think it's very, very important. Maybe this audience wouldn't be surprised to know that 51% of the entire surface of the United States is in one way or another, including Alaska, devoted to agriculture. If you're thinking just about croplands, it's somewhere around 23% or something like that. This is a very unknown statistic if you go outside of the agricultural community at all. Really, people do not have a sense of the scale on which we do agriculture, and it is entirely accurate to say we don't do anything, at least spatially, as much as we do agriculture in the United States. And in the world, it's about a third of the entire surface of the terrestrial surface of the earth that's utilized for agriculture. So we're doing a lot of it. But we are doing it with incredibly few people. In the United States in particular, fewer than 2% of Americans derive an income from agriculture, and fewer than half of that, so somewhere below 1%, are deriving primary income directly from agriculture. It's not that long that you have to go back where that number was over 50%, and it's really only a two generations ago where more than 50% of people had a relative at least as close as a cousin that lived on or operated a farm. So we've had a tremendous demographic shift that has led to the current state of affairs, which is essentially that farming has moved, on the one hand, from over the history of the United States into the regions we now associate with farming, which you see there on the right, and then on the left you see where population has developed. And so what this results in is that we have 80% of people where the farming isn't, and almost all the farming where the people are not, which is really a great thing in society, right? You know, we don't have 60% of people farming, that leaves a lot more, you know, doctors, nurses, librarians, poets, educators, you know, people pursuing really wonderful aspects of society, but it really is just a demographic trend that has led to the diminishment of our ability to understand and relate to agriculture on a daily basis. I think that it's fair to say that both the public garden communities and the agricultural communities have deeply neglected our agricultural roots and our have not thought thoughtfully as this demographic process has happened about how to remain active with both agriculture and the people whom we serve ultimately out in society. And so despite our little bit of neglect, the public has given us a tremendous gift, and that is through no credit to us, the urban public has decided to be really interested in agriculture. And a lot of us lament that maybe they're interested in the wrong parts of agriculture, they have a lot of misconceptions about agriculture, and those things are probably true. But considering that we haven't done a great job of really helping them understand agriculture, the fact that they're interested is a tremendous gift and a tremendous opportunity that I would suggest we ought not squander. And it's little stuff, right? So I've come from the Botanic Garden community, and I'll talk mostly about Botanic Garden examples, but you know, we have that amazing network of botanic gardens that Colin just showed you that attract how many millions of visitors at botanic gardens a year, public gardens? 120 million visitors at botanic gardens a year. Casey Sklar is in the back, the executive director of the American Public Garden Association. I will repeat his wonderful mantra that we do have more visitors at public gardens than all of the major sporting events combined. So more people every year are going to public gardens than attending National Football League, National Hockey League, ML, Major League Baseball, and soccer at all. And that number's going up for gardens, and it's staying pretty flat for sporting. So this is great, right? Let's be excited about that. And let's take these opportunities. Jude wonderfully recommended that we in the Botanic Garden community talk to our agriculture research folks. We decided to show food crops more in public garden settings, and we didn't know which rice to grow that works in a conservatory, a subtropical conservatory in Washington, D.C. You know, we called the Davis folks, the rice breeding folks, and said, hey, and they asked us three or four simple questions, and then as we said, can you send us a little seed? They sent us 4 pounds of seed, so we have a lot of rice seed. We needed about 10 grams. But most people have never seen rice grow on a plant. They've never seen that. And that is tremendously powerful, and that's actually not hard to do. then you can get even richer. This was an exhibit we did actually with the Smithsonian Museum of African American African art. And it was about how so many great things have come out of Africa, and they began to think in art terms and how vibrant they are. And then they asked if any institutions would want to partner with them, and we said, we'd love to. Let's show some African diaspora crops. And so this was a bed we did on African diaspora crops, focusing a little bit on okra and the movement of crops, species which are now associated with American culture that came along with enslaved peoples and all that history. Many institutions are doing this. There are these exemplars we've talked about, Chicago Botanic Garden with its urban agriculture program, which really started from a stated goal of decreasing recidivism among nonviolent offenders, utilizing agricultural skills as a tool to make that happen. And they succeeded really wonderfully. And so it's not always about food production, it's maybe about another goal, but agriculture becomes a very important social tool. Missouri Botanical Garden, doing some wonderful work. Also now doing research on grape rootstocks. A lot of people here probably know it's American grape rootstocks that are used for all European grapes to help protect against the insect Phylloxera. And so they're actually setting up in their display gardens agricultural trials in a way that's aesthetically pleasing. So bringing that knowledge aesthetic of agricultural research into that visible public garden setting. Jeff really wonderfully pointed out the need to engage on GMOs. The U.S. Botanic Garden has been growing GMOs for a long time. We're a little cagey. We call them BT. We don't say GMOs. People don't notice. But we'll talk about it. I used to love giving tours and walking by cotton plants and saying, here's the GMO cotton. You want a piece of it? Take it home. Go for it. That's a great way to just get people in touch with it. And we should embrace and not be afraid of these kinds of controversies. Breeding is just a fantastic topic. People are fascinated that little wild mustard plants can in Nebraska can get you this diversity of the vegetables that we have out there. And mentioned before, the Amber Ways of Grain exhibit, which was basically about wheat, celebrating Borlaug's statue in the U.S. Capitol. We did in 2014. Here is in the Capitol, and we thought, boy, if they're putting a plant scientist in the Capitol, then the Botanic Garden next door to the Capitol better grow some freaking plants that this guy did something with. And we did. We showed the plants that he grew. We talked about rust. We had a video that had been developed by the University of New Hampshire illustrating rust life cycles, right? That's tough. I barely remember that from my days in pathology. But we grew the varieties, so here we have them growing out. We took it as an opportunity to expand not only from traditional and modern wheat varieties, but Jerry will recognize a little bushel of Kernza right there on the right. So it's some of the work at the Land Institute, looking at what the next generation perennial of staple crops. We looked at the ancient grains. Mark Sorrell's in here, but up at Cornell. I think Jude actually made this connection for us, helped us get to their small grains lab, because it's hard to get seed for spelt and emmer and einkorn, at least for people like us. And we did this right at the base of the Capitol. We commissioned an artist to give us to make a wheat sculpture. We then built a bed around that wheat sculpture and planted it with the common field weeds of wheat to explain to people that a farmer can lose 50% of their crops if they don't control weeds. And here are the weeds that impact wheat. How much can we impact on this? Here's the Borlaug, 20 years of Borlaug's breeding program replicated in one series of beds. You could walk around it and see 20 years of progression. Jude was my hero. A couple of these needed to be vernalized. We can't vernalize. He could. Thank you, Jude. We talked about the varieties, gave a little bit of information. Some of them lodged. That was great. It gave us an opportunity to explain what they were breeding for and why. And then here we have the six commercial classes of wheat, so that allowed us to talk about how wheat is actually used today. And here are some of the ancient progenitors, as well as you have durum wheat used for pasta all the way there on the left. It's a poor phosphorus uptake plant, right, which is part of why it gets a price premium. This is a common garden experiment. It's all the same soil. It's a little yellow. Right, that's an opportunity to educate the public because that's right there. This is a physiological response. And when it was done, we didn't know what to do. We were like, Jude, we have to have this thing up for 6 months. What do we do? And Jude says, do what farmers do, rotate the soil. And we did. We kept the wheat signs up, but we explained why we did it. And farmers rotate. We did what they did. It was a really wonderful opportunity. All right, let me move fast. Jerry talked about exposed, and I'm not going to say more about it. Wonderful exhibit. People really up close and personal with roots. Loved it, and then we added on this element. There's this creativity, these design folks out there in the world who say, let's pair this with a root sculpture. We got an artist to donate this sculpture for our use for this exhibit, which just I was eye-catching and brought people in. Both the wheat exhibit and the exposed roots exhibit had 600,000 visitors each. And so moving forward, we have to continue to get really aggressive. The public is interested in kind of futuristic topics. You know, they may not pan out in terms of actual production scenarios, but why not talk about them? I mean, every one of them is an opportunity to go and explain plant physiology, plant growth, and some of these out there ideas may work out. But the point is that the public's imagination, where it's captured, we have to go meet them where they are. I love this was, I think, the Wheat Association organized to plant a wheat field and put a combine out on the mall several years ago, just showing actual production agriculture in the urban context, just showing it. You know, what you'll see if you went to a farm in the farming regions of the country is just super powerful by itself. And I want to just sort of close with this comment that it's not only about gardens. This is the Great Park in Orange County in Irvine, California. This is a former marine base, El Toro, about 1,700 acres there. They have redesigned this concept several times, and the city council just approved a version of it that includes a 70-acre urban production farm. And so I think as we move forward, we're going to see that not only public gardens and places that are kind of allied and thinking about agriculture, but almost every kind of green public space is going to begin going through a process of, do we include agriculture, and if so, how? And the answer to that question of the former will be yes, a lot of the times, and the how is an interesting thing that we don't know yet. And this is going to become a part of our tapestry. People don't think about how in the 1800s, how we were going to do parks was not figured out. And with the efforts of really strong people in the horticultural community, we've enshrined into our zoning and coding ordinances that parks have to exist, and they have to exist in a certain way. I suspect over the next 20 or 30 years, we're going to be changing those laws at a local level in a way that promotes agricultural production in the urban environment, with a tremendous opportunity to create nexus and opportunity to communicate with the production environments that produce most of our food and calories outside of our urban context, but where the people are. So please think about that. Some of us have been thinking about this for a little while, a couple of papers and some glossy stuff. We'd be happy to get you. A couple of people are in the room who are an author on this paper, Nature Plants. And I'm going to stop there so we have some time to talk.